This week's Please Explain segment, the third in our series, How to Save the World, is about climate change and how we may be able to stop it. Joining us now for a discussion of carbon emissions and also how and why they are causing climate change and how to address climate change with sustainable energy and new technologies like carbon sequestration are David Archer, professor of geophysical sciences at the University of Chicago, author of The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of the Earth's Climate, published by Princeton University Press. Also, Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, which is published by Wiley. And Klaus Lackner, director of the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He's invented a synthetic tree that can capture carbon dioxide from the air. I'm very pleased to welcome the two of you to our show.
Thank you.
And we also invite listener questions and comments. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. David, let's begin with you. One metaphor for addressing climate change is an ocean liner traveling at full speed, which would take a lot of effort and time to slow down and reverse. What will it take to actually slow and then begin to reverse the effects of climate change?
Well, the momentum of the ocean liner you're talking about, it seems to me, is industrial. It's not. It seems to me that if we were just running out of coal, we'd come up with new ways of developing energy without too much problem. The question is just making a decision to leave the coal in the ground, and it sort of seems to me that we could make that decision as quickly as we want. But I'm not an energy guy like Mr. Lochner, for example.
But at the moment, do you think we're still going full speed ahead?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the rate of CO2 emissions is higher than the worst-case scenarios that people were talking about just a few years ago.
Do we have environmental damage that would be hard to reverse?
Well, the changes to Earth's climate will persist for a very long time, and we're already seeing sort of drought conditions and extreme weather events around the world. So, those are going to last for quite a while.
Now, Klaus, what causes carbon emissions? Do they all come from burning fossil fuels?
Not all, but nearly all. In a way, we have lots of carbon locked up underground. We have some natural CO2 in the atmosphere. When we started in the Industrial Revolution, the atmosphere had 280 parts per million, which was just right to keep the climate where it belongs. And by now, we have driven it up to 390, and we are going up roughly 2 a year. The process is accelerating. And just as you heard a second ago, in a way, the problem is not the rate at which we are emitting, but the total amount we have emitted. Once it's there, about half of it stays. The other half seems to go into the ocean gradually. And if you give it 100,000 years, yes, it goes away. But on a human lifetime, you may assume what we put out stays. And so the damage we create is cumulative, and it doesn't just revert by itself.
Well, we've gone up 110 parts since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But the bulk of the carbon was already out there, 280 parts per million. That was because people still burn fossil fuels like wood, or was it because of just natural causes?
That's the natural background, and David probably can say more about it than I can. There's a natural background between plants absorbing CO2, plants releasing CO2, geological cycles releasing CO2 at volcanoes and taking it back as carbonates. So there's an equilibrium in the system which has been outside of the ice ages around 280 parts per million, and during the ice ages at about 180 parts per million. So the system has been stable there, and we have pushed it around quite hard in the last 100 to 200 years, and mostly, by the way, in the last 30, 40 years.
How does CO2 in the atmosphere cause warming?
It's a greenhouse gas. So it's a gas that is very good at letting visible light in, but it traps the infrared by which the Earth sheds the heat again. All the sunshine which comes in has to leave again, and it leaves as infrared. and the CO2 puts the brakes on this. And as a result, the planet gets warmer if it has a blanket of CO2 around it.
So, David, Klaus suggested that we've gone through natural cycles over the course of Earth's history. What are some ways to measure how much carbon was in the atmosphere 1,000 years ago?
Well, there are little tiny samples of ancient atmosphere preserved in ice cores. As an oceanographer, I would love to get my hands on samples of the oceans 20,000 years ago, but nothing like that is available. But the atmospheric chemists are lucky. They have these bubbles of ice in ice cores that can tell, measure very precisely the concentrations of CO2 and also other greenhouse gases like methane in the atmosphere through time.
Do we know how much was in the atmosphere 1,000 years ago? Would it have been that same 280 parts per million?
It rose. The last glacial maximum was about 20,000 years ago, and as Klaus said, the CO2 was about 180 or 200 parts per million then, which was a large part of the reason why it was so much colder during the Ice Age. When the Ice Age ended, the ice sheets melted and the CO2 concentration rose to about 260, and then over the last 10,000 years, it rose gradually for natural reasons, is what most people believe, up to the what we call the natural value of about 280, which is what the concentration was in about the year 1750.
Can you explain what an increase in global temperature by even 2 or 3 degrees means for the planet?
Well, it doesn't sound like very much, but the change in temperature going from the present climate back to the Ice Age, when you could walk from England to France or from Alaska to Russia probably because sea level was 120 meters lower. It was a different, totally different climate, a different planet. That was only 5 or 6 degrees centigrade. So if we talk about a warming of 3 degrees centigrade, which is sort of a middle-of-the-road estimate for the end of the century, it's a lot. It's like a fever. It's a much more profound effect on things like storminess and the balance of precipitation and evaporation, drought, than it sounds like.
And it has an impact on everything: crops, water supply.
I've heard it referred to as global weirding because it just sort of scrambles everything. Everything is just different than you know, you remember it used to be.
Klaus, can you explain the albedo effect and what it means for the melting of the polar ice cap?
Well, albedo just means that some of the visible light the sun shines on us is reflected out. And so that doesn't have to be transported past the CO2 as infrared. So the more we reflect, the higher our albedo, the less light actually gets stuck on the planet, the less energy gets stuck. And if you change the albedo, then more gets absorbed. So if you have ice sheets, they tend to be white and they reflect a lot. And so they don't absorb much heat. If you now remove them and you have open ocean, the sunlight gets absorbed, so more of the energy from the sun gets stuck on the surface of the planet and has then to be transported out of the atmosphere again and ultimately radiated away as infrared radiation. The consequence of that is the effect is self-amplifying. It gets warmer, the ice is removed, and therefore the sun gets more effective at heating us up.
Now, David, what are some of the other greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change? Methane, is that an important one?
Methane is about half as important as CO2 in terms of how much humans have affected the climate.
Well, let me put a caller on who wants to talk about methane. Miriam, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to be on your show. My question would be for the scientist about the methane gas. I've heard that the effect of the methane gas would be 20 times worse than the effect of CO2 on the planet Earth, on our environment. And that's part one of the question. Part two is there is the permafrost in Siberia, and I'm not an expert, this is only things that I've heard of, the permafrost in Siberia, which is because of, which is being thawed right now because of this crazy weather that we have and this huge perturbation of the weather on Earth. So first question is the methane effect comparing to the CO2. The second part is the permafrost in Siberia, and what would be the effect? What do you think would be the effect?
The melting of the permafrost.
Yes, exactly, the melting thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Doctors?
You are absolutely right that molecule per molecule, methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2. And the factor of 20 that you've come up with is a particularly fancy comparison that tries to take into account the fact that the methane doesn't last as long as the CO2. So they use something called global warming potentials. But the bottom line is that we're putting out so much more CO2 than methane that even though a molecule of CO2 may only be worth 20 or maybe 40 molecules, sorry, 20 or 40 molecules of CO2 would equal one molecule of methane, we're putting out so much more CO2 that the overall effect of how much the atmosphere has changed due to human activity is bigger due to CO2 than to methane.
But where does methane come from? Isn't that also a part of, haven't we added to the amount of methane in the atmosphere
absolutely.
Simply by domesticating animals?
We have that route. We also have natural gas pipelines, and a little bit of that we lose. So overall, we have certainly contributed to the methane background. But overall, and this is an important distinction, methane in a few decades will decay away. As a matter of fact, and with all the oxygen in the air, eventually it turns out to become CO2. But since we put very little in comparison to CO2, that is not too bad. But what really the difference is the CO2 will be around, and the CO2 levels, once you raise them, will be out there for a very long time. So part of the argument I would make is we probably already have too much CO2 in the atmosphere for comfort, but it doesn't really matter. We have this enormous industry which puts 30 billion tons of CO2 in the air and is able of raising the level in the air every year by 2 ppm. If you're a skeptic, you may think 450 is okay and 550 is okay, but if we don't do anything, we will get to 1,000 before the century is out.
What about Miriam's other question about the melting of the permafrost?
That's another one, and David probably knows more, is a positive feedback, right? If you warm things up, there is methane stored in the ground in the permafrost. It turns out there are certain forms of ice which hold CO2, and if you warm it up and they release the CO2, there's an additional emission over which we have no control.
The issue, though, with permafrost melting and releasing methane, either by melting of hydrates or decomposing of the peat, the organic matter that's there, is how quickly it can release the methane. So if it could release it all at once within a year or something like that, within a time frame that's short compared to how long methane lasts in the atmosphere, which is about 10 years, then you'd get this spike of methane concentration and it would have a very strong climate impact. But when you think about or try to understand the way that permafrost melts or hydrates in the ocean could decompose and release methane, it seems like a long process that would take many decades to release the methane, in which case it will sort of decompose in the atmosphere as you're releasing it. So you get higher concentrations of methane in the atmosphere, but it isn't as catastrophic as it sounds. A lot of people are very, very concerned about this methane because if you could somehow make it all come out all at once, it could really clobber us. But no one has proposed a mechanism that would make it all come out at once like that. And if it comes out slowly, it's much less harmful.
Scott from Newark, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I don't disagree about the concerns of global warming or the science of it. You know, there are some beneficial impacts, some food plants and other, forests and so forth actually grow better, and in the northern Canadian areas they may be able to grow crops.
Scott, what's your question?
So I really have a question. My concern is that this intense focus on global warming has essentially hijacked the primary attention of the environmental movement. And global warming is essentially a consequence of the vast overpopulation of the human species. And if we had a machine tomorrow that could instantly suck out CO2 and pull it back down to the desirable 200 levels, we would still be faced with massive other problems. And all this attention is focused on global warming, whereas we just don't have enough water, we don't have enough space. The overall impact of 7 billion, soon to be 10 billion people, is far greater than global warming.
David?
Yes.
Do you want to respond to that? He says it's an overpopulation problem rather than a CO2 problem in itself. We wouldn't have all of these emissions if we didn't have so many people on Earth.
I think it's an American way of life problem. The Europeans and the Japanese emit half as much CO2 as we do, and they have perfectly delightful standards of living in my limited experience. If everybody on the planet tried to live like Americans, the total footprint of the population would go up by a factor of five. So the problem is not just raw numbers. The problem is how we are living our lives.
My guests on today's Please Explain It, David Archer, professor of geophysical sciences at the University of Chicago, author of a number of books on climate change, and Klaus Lackner, director of the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy at Columbia University's Earth Institute, inventor of a synthetic tree that can scrub carbon dioxide from the air. And let's talk about that, Klaus. Is carbon sequestration a viable plan for lowering greenhouse gases?
Well, carbon sequestration more broadly deals with managing the carbon which comes from the use of fossil fuels. And I would argue, given the inertia in our energy systems and the rapid growth you see in the rest of the world, I don't think we have terribly much choice. I would argue as long as a ton of carbon comes out of the ground, another ton has to be put away in order to stabilize the CO2 level in the atmosphere. If you have to come back down, then you really have to take it back out of the air. And with regard to what the last caller said, yes, having 7 billion people on the planet, soon to be 10, we live a life which can only be supported with technology. We have, in a way, no choice but to use energy and to make things happen, which allow us to support these people. Because if you turn it around, if you look at mammals our size, the typical population density is 3 per square kilometer. For us, it's about, in New Jersey, it's 450. So we have learned, with the help of technology, to support a lifestyle which otherwise would be not supportable. And the European lifestyle may only put half of this out, but if 10 billion people were to do half of what we do or what the Europeans do right now, it's still too much. So we will have to figure out how to have an energy system that does not release CO2 into the atmosphere. And you have two choices. Either you abandon fossil fuels more or less immediately, and I think practically we haven't figured out how to do that. And the other option is to figure out how to deal with the CO2, which means at the power plants you must capture it and dispose of it. At the distributed sites, if you have airplanes and cars, they produce CO2 and it's virtually impossible to collect it on board. The airplane couldn't carry it. You would have 6 big steel bottles full of CO2 in the car by the time you get back to your filling station. So this is not practical. So then you have to ask the question, could you get CO2 back out of the atmosphere? And you may have to do it anyhow, because if people like Jim Hansen are right, we should have stopped at 350 parts per million. And we have to figure out how to come back. And the air doesn't give it back voluntarily. So it takes time to bring it back, and that's part of why I'm working on developing sorbent materials, which, like the leaves on a tree, can absorb CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Is it shaped like a tree?
Well, it could be. I feel we are in the early stages, like when windmills were first proposed. They had all sorts of shapes, but I see it as like leaves, like pine needles, or like furnace filters where the air blows through and these surfaces bind to the CO2 which comes through, and then you have to free it again, and then you have to process that CO2. So in the end, you have to have a place where you want to put the CO2. So this is either making minerals out of it or inject it below ground, or if you have the renewable energy to do it, turn it back into fuels. But then you need energy from windmills or solar panels to provide that.
Now, Betsy on the Upper West Side asks, let's say we find a way to sequester carbon. Do we run the risk of taking too much out? If so, what would happen then?
Well, I would argue it's never free to take the CO2 out, and you can see it, right? We change the CO2 content of the air by less than a percent per year. And if we were very aggressive to move back the other direction, maybe we can drop it down by 0.5% a year. But we would notice if we get too far. And since it costs money to do, I presume we would stop before we get too low. I don't think anybody is proposing to go below 280 parts per million because we don't want to get into an ice age either.
Has there been a lot of funding for this kind of development of technology?
There has been funding for capturing at power plants. There has been very little funding for capturing from the air.
David, let's talk about another kind of sequestration, soil. Are there bacteria, organisms that could dispose of CO2, like algae that would feed on carbon dioxide?
Algae can take up carbon dioxide, but it takes energy to do this. This is photosynthesis, so there has been some talk of fertilizing the ocean with iron to prompt the plankton to take up more carbon dioxide. But there's a long exchange time for CO2 between the atmosphere and the ocean. So if you were to fertilize the ocean maybe for 500 years, you might start to get somewhere. But if you do it for just a few, you know, for a few decades, it's not very effective. There is, I don't know much about it, but there is talk about adding charcoal, sort of char, to soils, and this helps the soil absorb carbon in some way that's supposed to be quite effective. I don't know much about that.
Well, the basic idea there is that in some soils you find what amounts to charcoal, which has been there for hundreds of years, and so the suggestion has been made we could, in effect, take biomass, wood, and turn it into charcoal and then spread the charcoal in the soil. The danger with all of these things is if you grow the algae or you put the charcoal away, you now created a form of carbon which is chemically much more active because it's energetically higher, so you can oxidize it again, and you have to make sure that at the end of the day you don't produce more methane than you absorbed CO2. So those are the issues. One shouldn't belittle. If you actually deal with 30 billion tons of CO2 a year, we have no experience how to do that and where to put it, and we have to be careful that we do it right.
But you suggested earlier that we could make hydrocarbon fuels from CO2.
We could, and this is like photosynthesis, right? But then you.
But we would be doing it ourselves with your trees.
Yes, because it would be faster and possibly more efficient. And so people have been looking at various ways of what you might call artificial photosynthesis. In this case, you would need CO2, and you electrolyze water to make hydrogen, and hydrogen and CO2 can react to make methanol. And people have processes to make for methanol, gasoline, or diesel, or dimethyl ether, or whatever fuel you would like. So this could be done and close the cycle, but to be honest about it, you first need very cheap electricity, otherwise you cannot afford it, or fuel will be much more expensive than it is today.
Are these synthetic trees in development? Are they being manufactured?
They are in the development stage where we are starting to do this. I'm involved with a company in San Francisco who is trying to make a first prototype. I'm also researching the particular phenomenon which is underlying the process in the laboratory. So there is discussions about it, there is research going on, but you cannot buy devices to do this right now. The closest you come is a tree. Right? And just like a tractor is much better than a horse pulling pulling a plow, we feel we, in the end, will be much more efficient in collecting CO2 from the air than a tree ever could be.
David, can you tell us about ultramafic rocks that are found in the Sierra Nevadas?
It feels like a pop quiz here.
Are there enough rocks?
So I assume the angle here is that these rocks can react with CO2 to sequester the carbon to make carbonate rocks. This is one strategy that we talked about for sequestering CO2 instead of squirting it down into the earth in a liquid form, trying to react it with rocks to make other rocks that then would not have any possibility of leaking back to the atmosphere. And this is actually what happens in the natural world with CO2, that the natural cycle that sets the 280 parts per million, the way that CO2 is ultimately removed is by these kinds of chemical reactions. So
yeah, in 1995,
it'd be possible to accelerate them.
Yeah, in 1995, I wrote a paper on it, probably the first time that somebody seriously studied looking at these rocks and see how to turn them industrially into carbonates. The other option is to go into either ultramafic or basalt rocks and inject CO2 below ground, and then you wait 20, 30 years, and it has formed carbonate. So it's, again, the same natural weathering process. The ultramafic rocks like peridotites and serpentinites, they actually react fast enough that you could do it in an industrial setting. There's a study going on in Canada right now that certain mines which have mined through these materials actually spontaneously pull some CO2 out of the air because these rocks are so good at doing that. So, and it turns out the biggest deposit of those is in Oman. And a colleague of mine, Jörg Mutter, is going there regularly trying to figure out how to make that happen. He's working also with Peter Kellerman on that.
Now, wind and solar panel have been growing in usage, but not at the rate that natural gas use is. Are these clean energy sources capable of creating the kind of power that coal does?
There are problems in doing that, but I think in the long term it has a solution. My own view is there will never be enough wind for world consuming energy like we do at the 10 billion people scale, but there's certainly enough solar energy. We have to figure out how to deal with the natural intermittency at night when you really want electricity. You don't have sunshine, and so those are issues which need to be resolved, how to store this. Making fuels out of it is, by the way, one way of solving that problem. In the short term, there's an awful lot of natural gas, and I think right now we are actually going through a transition. In 2000, there was a general belief that the natural gas in the lower 48 states in the U.S. was running out. And now we seem to have a nearly unlimited supply, and natural gas prices have dropped dramatically. So there will be an enormous competition from natural gas. And from a carbon dioxide point of view, what's nice about it is that a coal plant makes significantly more. A natural gas-fired power plant makes maybe 40% of the CO2 emissions of a coal plant for the same amount of electricity. So that's good, but by the time you replaced all coal with natural gas, you are stuck at that 40%, and that is still too much.
David, what about clean coal technology that the president touted during his campaign? We hardly hear about it anymore. Does it work? Is it really cleaner?
Well, there's ways of chemically extracting the energy from the coal without actually burning it, and when you do that, it leaves the CO2 product in a form that's easier to capture. So, if you did that, you could capture and sequester the CO2 more easily. It also, as a byproduct, reduces emission of mercury and sulfur and things like that.
Now, a listener, Tom in Brooklyn, reminds us that Gernot Wagner was on our show a couple of weeks back, and he suggested including the environmental costs of production in the price of a product. You think that would be a good way to to stimulate cutbacks in the production of things that are bad for the environment?
Sure. I think it would, but I think in a way that probably would be the most direct way of attacking the problem.
Making it economically advantageous.
Right, but one of the things which will happen is you won't pay for the damage, you will pay for avoiding the damage, and that may be less.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you both so much, Klaus Lackner, Director of the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and David Archer, Professor of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago.
Thanks
so much.
On Monday's show, two former opposition researchers explain how their field has become an integral part of modern political campaigning. And then Michael Oher, the football player who inspired the book and film The Blind Side, talks about his life and upbringing. Also, the BBC's A History of the World in 100 Objects continues with a look at a colossal statue of the Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II. Plus, Chris Lee talks about her collection of short stories called Drifting House, and we will look at how the creditors in today's global economy, namely China and the Middle East, will help shape much of the coming century. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Chrissy Goldaddy, Christina Maldonado, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. Andrew Dunn was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.